Sir Horace Lamb's solution, the scientific data has verified. The other is theory. His work has allowed us to predict what we would find in the future, and future measurements have substantiated his work. I guess I ought to add, Chapman and Bartelis have done a treatise on geomagnetism, and they give very little credence to the use of magnetism in rocks as an indication of the past state of the Earth's magnetic field. You see, what they've done now is they've taken these arrangements, random arrangements, and come up with and fabricated some sort of history of reversals of the Earth's wandering poles. You can read about this. It's very popular. But I'm just trying to show you that it's really based on incredible assumptions that are hard to stand by, and that the best data does not bear them out. Look, there's all kind of problems with this work. Lightning can magnetize rocks. Stresses and folding of strata can alter the orientation of the rock magnetizations. If you alter the direction of the magnetization by pressure and other stresses, that's very important. And to date, this seems to almost be ignored in selecting orientations for the reversal chronologies. The men that are studying this just seem to ignore it. Their interpretations seem to be an either-or option selected to fit their own assumed theory. The simple scientific fact is the strongest theoretical and observational evidence supports Horace Lamb's theory of a freely decaying current as the Earth's magnetic field, and the theory implies an initial created field in the not-too-remote past, and it's been decaying exponentially ever since. Since I know I've got a lot of you here present that are geologists and geophysicists and come from that kind of background, let me just say this to you about oil and gas deposits. Nobel Prize medalist Dr. Melvin Cook has studied oil and gas well pressures and the permeabilities of the surrounding trap formations. And these studies led him to conclude that the oil and gas deposits have probably resulted from sudden deep burial of organic material a relatively short time ago, but 5,000 and at most at 100,000 years ago. Now, of course, that directly contradicts the evolutionary uniformitarian theory that these trap formations have existed for hundreds of millions of years in some cases. Dr. Cook, now remember, this guy's a Nobel Prize winner, pointed out that the abnormally high pressures of up to 8,000 pounds per square inch that have been found relatively frequently in deep oil wells suggest that the oil was not in the ground for a long period of time. Using the measured values of the permeability of the rocks surrounding the oil well, it's possible to compute the time that it would take for the oil to seep through the rocks up to the surface. So Cook reported that the time required for a typical oil well to dissipate in this matter are on the order of 1,000 years, or thousands of years, and certainly less than 100,000 years. And these calculations are based on fluid dynamics, a fluid flow through a porous media. And that is an area of science that is considered to be very well proven and almost non-controversial. Incidentally, in the study by Hubert and Ruppe, on 8 cases that they studied, all the wells except one showed active seepage at the surface. And while I'm mentioning that, I think I ought to say this. You know, we're always told that it takes so many millions of years to produce oil and gas and everything for these hydrocarbons to break down, but that's not true at all. In laboratory experiments, we've taken garbage, and on the order of 20 minutes, with enough temperature and pressure, we've converted it into oil. So really, the only thing that's necessary is a sudden quick burial and significant pressure and temperature, not eons of time. Furthermore, it doesn't take rocks long to lithify. We've been told that it takes rocks ages and ages to cement and become from loose sediment, unconsolidated sediment, to become cemented rock. But that isn't true at all. All it takes is a good cementing agent. Something will cement together in just hours and days. If you've got the cementing agent present at the time of deposition, it takes almost no time for lithification to take place. Now, right about now, I know some of you are having a hard time believing in the magnitude of some of the geologic and geophysical stresses that I've been alluding to as having occurred in the past. Let me just speak to those of you that are Christians in here who are trying to be theistic evolutionists, okay? But you really believe Jesus Christ is the Messiah. He's the Savior of the world. If you can't believe that there were these kind of changes taking place back in Noah's day, you won't believe Revelations chapter 16 either. In Revelations chapter 16, for example, beginning to verse 18, it says there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake. And that word there for earthquake is the Greek word seismos, such as was not since men were on the face of the earth. was so mighty an earthquake and one so great. Verse 19 says that the cities of the nations all fell, all collapsed. And in verse 20 it says, every island fled away and the mountains were no longer found. In other words, God says, in one moment of time here, in the book of Revelations, before Jesus, at the time of Jesus' return, he's going to bring about topographic changes of incredible magnitude. Now, what I'm trying to get you to see is, if you can believe that in Revelations, then why can't you believe it in Genesis? Or, to put it another way, if you don't believe it in Genesis, then why should you believe it here in Revelations? You're just going to have to come grips with the fact that God, in the Bible, mentions in more than this place, I might add, fantastic topographic changes on the earth with the return of the Lord Jesus. So, fellows, are you going to trust God in His Word? I'm trying to get you to see that the last book in the Bible agrees with the first book of the Bible. So we see that oil and gas deposit formations really don't mitigate against a young earth at all. Another thing that's quite often used to prove that the earth is old, supposedly, and to really astound us, are the dripstone formations, you know, those of stalactites and stalagmites. Maybe you've been to Mammoth Cave in Kentucky or Carlsbad Cavern, and you've seen these tremendous formations, and the guide there probably told you that the formations took hundreds of thousands or even millions years to form. But the truth is that recent evidence shows that some of these estimates may be way too large. But for example, a curtain of stalactites has been discovered growing from the foundation ceiling beneath the Lincoln Memorial Building in Washington, D.C. And some of these stalactites, which are composed of calcium carbonate, were found to be as long as 5 feet in length in 1968. Now, the Lincoln Memorial Building was built in 1923, so the stalactites grew at an average rate of 1 1/3 inches per year. Now, that's a lot greater rate than we had formerly thought possible, and that would we could account for almost anything now with those kind of rates in just a few thousand years. Another thing that happened in 1971, they found stalactites 2 centimeters long under a spillway ceiling of an old dam in Salem, Oregon. Or at least near Salem, Oregon, and there was evidence of vandalism on the ceiling suggesting that the stalactites used to be longer. And it was only built in 1890 and was abandoned in 1912. In October 1953 issue of the National Geographic, there's further evidence of rapid growth of dripstones. For example, on page 442, there's a picture of a bat that's cemented upside down in a stalagmite. I've seen this picture myself. So the point is that before bacterial decay and or some kind of scavenger could take its toll on the carcass, it was entombed by the calcium carbonate. So based on these cases, it seems probable that the upper limit on the ages of these dripstone formations in the caves is on the order of just thousands or tens of thousands of years. Another thing that's been used in the past for geologists to believe maybe the Earth was very old was that of the growth of coral reefs. But you'll recall in 1883 there was an island called Krakatoa, and it blew apart, and it was a volcano. Well, a short period of time, people began to come back, and although all life had been killed and destroyed by the tremendous explosion, when people came back, they found out that coral reefs had grown to a thickness of about 4 centimeters, to where it had grown at a rate of about 4 centimeters per year. And that's an incredible growth. Other investigators have established reef growth between 0.1 to 5 centimeters per year. Now, if that's the case, and it is, I mean, those are the figures, the rate of growth would account for almost any coral reef depths found around the world, even during just a few thousand years. So the coral reefs don't really mean that they've taken great thousands and millions and billions of years to grow, as we were formerly taught and used to believe, and all the textbooks seem to still indicate. And so the point of all this, of course, is that evolution is facing a crisis, four of them. The first, that we've already studied, is that of mounting evidence for a young earth. There is mounting scientific evidence for a young earth. The Bible already told us that. But the second thing is, I'll mention them real quickly, the first and second law of thermodynamics. The theory of evolution goes completely contrary-wise to the two most honored, time-honored laws of science, the first and second law of thermodynamics, and I'll talk to you briefly about that in a few moments. Another crisis is the gaps in the fossils, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, the fossil gaps. And the fourth, there is no currently known mechanism to produce the changes that neo-Darwin evolution demands. There are none.
Now, they have always appealed to natural selection and mutations, but we're going to look at that tonight and show you some things that you need to know about that. Okay? You all want to know about the fossil men. Well, because there's all this talk in the pictures about all these fossil men. You've seen these all your life, you know, in the books. Here is this typical family lineage of the so-called Pliopithecus, Proconsul, Dialpithecus, Oreopithecus, Ramapithecus, Australopithecus, Homo erectus, Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, all the way to modern man. Now, you see all these all the time trying to show some common ancestor relationship that may have existed in the past. I'd like to spend a little time and just start at this and tell you a little bit about it.
Just listen to this one paragraph, if nothing else. A number of fossil men are now grouped together under the generic name Homo erectus, including the somewhat notorious Java man, we'll talk about him in a minute, Peking and Heidelberg man, and Meganthropus. They are believed to have lived about 500,000 years ago, have walked upright, to have brains of about 1,000 cc's, and to have developed crude culture involving simple instruments and weapons. The evidence for this, to say the least, is equivocal. The Java man was later repudiated by his discoverer. The discoverer said it was a hoax. It was just a big gibbon. The bones of the Peking man disappeared during World War II and are unavailable for examination. I'll tell you why in a minute. Heidelberg man consisted only of a large jaw. Meganthropus consisted of two lower jaw bones and four teeth and has now been assigned to the Australopithecines.
But no geologist or evolutionist or paleontologist, etc., today would tell you that a Pliopithecus was anything other than a monkey. And the same thing for Proconsul, though there was a time when they got pretty excited when they found him. Which brings us up to the third one here in this sequence called Dryopithecus. Now, the skeleton is very incomplete. There was a time that they thought they really had something when they found him, and they really beat the bushes. I'd like to give you a quote that I got from a scientific text on paleontology. Listen to this. He is generally assumed in a rather vague fashion. Did you hear that? Now, I thought this was science. Now, wait a minute, y'all. You know, it is generally assumed in a rather vague fashion, and then they go on and on. But the best thinking today, and I'll quote one of them named Philbin, he says he was too specialized and too committed to apedom to ever produce a hominid. Now, two words I'm going to teach you. Hominid means man, okay? Hominoid is a critter that when you look at his bones, you're not sure whether he was a man or an ape, okay? Hominoid can be either. They say, okay, this one definitely now, today, everyone says, okay, fellas, we're going to go along with it. He's definitely not a man. And so, Oreopithecus was next, and they thought they had something, but, beloved, they found out Oreopithecus was nothing but an ape. Now then comes Ramapithecus, and because what they found was a few teeth and some fragments of a jaw, and they got real excited about him because of his teeth. There are several things I need to educate you on very quickly. The shape of man's jawbone looking down is that of a parabola. In other words, it's kind of curved like this. Whereas apes have a jawbone that curves like a U, like this. So that usually you can tell whether you've got an ape or a man by the shape of the jawbone. Also, man's palate, the upper part, tends to arch way up, and the apes tends to be pretty flat. You know, you can stick your tongue up kind of high, and apes can't. Those are a few things. So this one, and also apes, you see, and gibbons and baboons, etc., tend to have very large canine teeth and large front teeth in comparison to the size of their back teeth, where man, see, ours are about the same, right? No big difference in the size of the teeth. So this fellow, Ramapithecus, has teeth much like ours. And the curvature had some merit. The curvature was kind of like man's, more like a parabola than the typical U. So boy, everyone got excited. Now, I want you to see this. You see that drawing there? All they found were a few teeth and some fragments of a jaw. Now, beloved, that picture cannot be done. Now, they do it all the time. But really, you cannot tell what a creature looks like. Now, I'm just going to give you an example. I'm going to show you two pictures drawn by evolutionists. Both are evolutionists of the same fossil. This is what one made him look like. You can see that he wanted him to be the missing link real bad, didn't he? See that one? The other one, both of them evolutionists, taking the same data, drew one like that. Does that give you some idea of how inexact what we're talking about is? One looks just exactly like a gorilla with a big grin on his face, and the other looks like your great-great-granddaddy, maybe, you know, with a flat head. But there is no way. Oh, it's true, we can study the muscle scars on the bone and get some idea of the muscle formation. But, beloved, you cannot draw something like this from teeth. Shall we say teeth do not the man make? Okay? Now, let's see what actually happened when we began to study. So what happened was, they said, since this guy's teeth were so much more like a man's, that is, Ramipithecus's, than Dryopithecus, maybe we had something. So an evolutionist up at Penn State began a study.
What he did was, he took some chimpanzees from a zoo and in captivity and compared them. He made 24 different measurements of chimps in captivity against chimps over in Africa in the wild that he measured having to do with their teeth. And he examined them to see how much range and how much difference there was between living chimpanzees, the only difference is somewhere in the zoo and somewhere in the wild, as opposed to some of the teeth between Dryopithecus and Ramipithecus. And what he found out was that there was a greater genetic variation in the teeth of living chimpanzees in captivity as opposed to those in the wild than there were between the teeth of the Dryopithecus and the Ramipithecus. And of course, what that shows is that dental criteria are very uncertain, and that just because a critter has teeth that look more like a human teeth does not make him a man. It's not, for example, the opposition of the thumb and the finger that makes a man, and makes him a tool user over the other animals. You know, our thumbs oppose our fingers, where a monkey's or an ape's, his thumb does not oppose him so that he can't grasp curled around like we do. But see, it's not the opposition of a thumb and a finger that makes a man a tool user over the other animals. The thing that makes a man, when it comes down to it, is intellectual difference. It's his self-consciousness and self-awareness. It's his God-consciousness and his God-awareness. And we are the only creature on this planet that can write a book on psychology or theology as a result of being self-conscious and God-conscious. That's the difference. It's not teeth, and it's not opposing thumbs and fingers.
And now all of them agree that Ramipithecus is definitely ape. And I might add that they got excited about this parabolic jaw. But we've now discovered a living high-altitude baboon called a Galeta baboon in Ethiopia, and he has teeth much like ours, small in front and small in back, and he has much more of a parabolic shape. So we've got living ones, okay, that don't fit the exact mold. So, crunch. In other words, the dental criteria simply is not as diagnostic as has been published and put out. In fact, that living one has some facial features much like man. Okay, so do you see what I just did? I just knocked out those five, okay? Everyone now agrees that they're definitely not man. Australopithecus. Boy, we really thought we had something when we found Australopithecus. Now, this one and this one are called Australopithecus, okay? They were discovered in 1924 by a man named Dart. Most of the workers that were with him in the first one they found was Australopithecus africanus. That's this one. This one is called Australopithecus robustus. Okay, you'll find out why in a few minutes. This one that we found, the remains, if you put some meat on him, probably would have weighed 60 or 70 pounds. Okay, pretty small. And most of the workers that were with Dart in 1924 and examined it said, the thing's an ape. But Dart wanted to, you know, he really began to beat the drums real big. And a little bit later, they found this Australopithecus, and the book said that this one was the first hominid. In other words, definitely the one that was in the lineage to man. Definitely man, okay? And says they may have used stones. That's scientific. May, all right? Now, this one, the bigger one, Australopithecus robustus, they found some fragments and some foot bones and some pelvis bones, and the curve of his jaw was somewhat parabolic, like a man. His skull cranial capacity was about 500 cc's, and he had an ape-like skull and an ape-like jaw. And you see, supposedly, man has branched off, according to neo-Darwin evolution, about 30 to 70 million years ago, man branched off and went one way from this common ancestor, and the ape went the other way, all right? And so this guy, they really thought they had something with him. He had this a much larger cranial capacity than Australopithecus africanus. He was bigger, stronger, bigger jaw, bigger teeth, bigger everything. And so they thought they had two totally different species. The current best thinking is, by all the evolutionary scientists, is that was the female, africanus was the female, and robustus was the male. Wrong again. Now, I might add that the female, Lewis Leakey, the one you've heard so much about, found another one of those in the Olduvai Gorge over in Africa, and as usual, National Geographic published a tremendous write-up on it and gave extravagant claims to it. National Geographic is really dedicated to evolution, and every time they find anything, their claims are so exaggerated that you just can't believe the thing they say almost. And so Leakey came out and gave it a new name and called it Zinjanthropus. And later he found out it was really just old Australopithecus africanus that had already been discovered, so he backed off of that. Now, we really figured we had something here. And then Lewis Leakey died. The daddy died, and his son, Richard, continued the work. And about 3 years ago, Richard found something they hadn't found before. He found almost a complete arm bone and leg bone. Now let me tell you what the results of that was. Now, you need to have this little piece of information. The average ape, full-grown ape's cranial capacity, brain capacity, how much brain is 500 cc's, approximately one-third of the typical average human being. Okay? Now remember, Robustus had a cranial capacity of 500 cc's. The latest find by Richard Leakey shows that his arms were extremely long and hung down below his knees, that when he hurried, he ran on his knuckles and his feet, and that his legs were short. Now let's see if I got the picture. I got something with a brain capacity of 500 cc's, runs on his knuckles and feet, and his arms come down below his knees. What am I? An ape. And Richard Leakey concluded the same thing, that it's an ape. Have you got the picture? I just knocked out those two. Okay? Do you see what I'm doing? We're going right down the list. Next, Homo erectus, the Peking man, the Peking man here. Now, they found him near, this is one of the great frauds of all time. Peking man is one of the great frauds of all time. And I want to just tell you a little bit about him. There he is. Okay? A man named Black, who was a paleontologist living near Peking, China, back during just before the war, found a tooth, one lousy tooth, and he published. That's very scientific. He couldn't wait to do a good, thorough investigation. You see these guys, let me tell you something you all have to understand. Men in the scientific world have the same problems as everyone else. They want big, famous names. Ego and arrogance drive us. I know I was one. And sometimes we let that way outdo the scientific method. All he found was one tooth, and he published. Now later, between 120 and 130 fragments of skulls, of about 30 skulls and 11 lower jaw bones and 147 teeth and some limb fragments were found. All the skulls were cracked and crushed into little bitty bits in this beast. Okay, this guy that was a professor of anatomy, this Black, he was a professor of anatomy, actually twisted the facts that he found to try and promote this thing instead of a species to a genera status. He wanted a big name. Almost nobody could get in there and look at it during that period of time, just before the war in China, near Peking. But two French paleontologists, Boll and Varlas, who were two of the world's greatest paleontologists. In fact, Boll was, I forget his exact title, but he was director of the paleontological and all that type jazz in France, and was recognized without question, these two men, as being two of the greatest paleontologists of that day. They got in, took a look at it, and their quote is, he was very ape-like and monkey-like, definitely an animal, not a man. Now, that's what they said, okay? They were evolutionists. That was their opinion. In fact, this guy, we're going to find out as we go on, is actually the same thing as the Java man. Now, Later, another guy came in and began to work with Black, and he wrote descriptions. See, they pieced the skull together with the fragments, and they wrote descriptions of what it looked like, and they published the descriptions and sent them all over the world. But nobody could see the thing, okay? You couldn't see the skull, but here's what it looks like. Later, another guy joined Black, got in there, German, and he made some plastic models of it. Okay? He made some models. After the war, everything disappeared except the model and a couple of teeth. But none of the bones, the skull bones, could be found. That was the only thing that disappeared. He said the Japanese got them, but there was a Catholic priest in the area that said the Japanese did not come within 20 miles of where he was working. Isn't it odd? The only thing missing was a skull. Now let me tell you the worst part. If you read the description and look at the model that that guy made, they don't fit. They don't even come close. So in other words, all the evidence of the Peking man has been missing. No one's ever seen it except those two Frenchmen and these two guys that flat altered the facts. Now, I might add, there's an interesting story with him. You'll be real interested in this. You see, they found him with all these bashed-in skulls. I mean, the skulls just crushed about 30 skulls. And so everyone did some thinking, and there was only one intelligent solution. Somebody busted the skulls open to get the brains out to eat the brains. Now, this put them on the horns of a dilemma. And so, they figured that they had to be cannibals. Because you see, beloved, if there was a creature around that was bigger and more powerful than he was, that hunted him and ate him, then this guy couldn't be in man's lineage, could he? The hunter was more powerful and more advanced. Therefore, their only conclusion to save the baby and to keep the dying dog going was he had to be a cannibal. Necessity is the mother of invention, isn't it? Hallelujah. Isn't that brilliant scientific work? Now, I might add that in 1922 they found a tooth up in Nebraska and called this and drew a whole picture of a man, just like you see here, and called him the Nebraska man. And from 1922 to 1927, they gave him a big scientific name. I can't remember what it was. It isn't worth remembering. And said, man, we've got it, we've got it. And they drew pictures in the paper and illustrations and all this stuff, and he published. And in 1927, they found out it was a pig's tooth. And I would say that that was the first time that a pig ever made a monkey out of an evolutionist. Hallelujah. Then, of course, most of you know in 1912, there was the infamous Piltdown man. They found the jawbone, looked like the jawbone of an ape and the skull of a man. And the circumstances were kind of vague, and a lot of people were skeptical, but the truth of the matter is that from 1912 to about 1950, the evolutionists just jumped up and down on the Christian and said, man, we found him. We've got a half-man, half-ape skull. But around 1950, and I have to give the scientists credit, a group of them did a thorough study on that skull and on that jawbone, and they found out that it was a tremendous hoax, that they had taken these bones and soaked them in iron salts to make them look old, and to make them age, to age the bone, and they had taken files and filed on the teeth to make them look very old, and that the entire thing was a hoax. It really was the skull of a man and the jawbone of an ape. And so that was another hoax. All right, I'm just killing a few extras while I'm killing, okay? Now, how's about, this one's called Solo Man or the Java Man because he was found in Java. We found two shin bones and some fragmentary pieces of skull. We gave him a name called Pithecanthropus erectus, which means the erect ape man. Okay? Now they've changed that name to Homo erectus, which is the same thing they gave to this guy back here that we call Peking man. Now, beloved, he was discovered in 1891 by a man named Dubois. From the skull cap, we have estimated his brain capacity might have been 900 cc's. Now, the average human would be somewhere around 1,100 to 1,500 or 1,600 cc's. Okay, something like that. So, but you really can't make that accurate an estimation from a skull cap. A year later, after they found the shin bones and femur, they found two molar teeth, and then 7 years later they found one premolar tooth, and they just assumed they were all the same critter. But there was no scientific evidence whatsoever to illustrate that or to demonstrate that or to prove that. None. Now, Du Bois tried to convince, and just about did convince, almost everybody that he really had a, quote, man-ape, a person in the lineage of the common ancestor. But, beloved, he was a fraud. He didn't tell us that in the cave that he found these bones, that just above that cave was another cave with two skulls in it that had brain capacities of about 1,500 cc's, in other words, like that of a modern man. For 30 years, he concealed that information from the rest of the world because he knew that if we all knew that, we wouldn't buy this story either. Because don't you understand, the point is that what probably happened is this critter was probably a gibbon or something like that that these other skulls, these men, killed and ate. I don't know if you know it, but over in the Philippine Islands and places like that, well, they eat monkeys all the time. I mean, this is a common thing over in that part of the world. And he knew that if he let the world know, see, they're after big names. And so, beloved, before Du Bois died, he said, this thing was not a man. I have exaggerated. It is actually a large gibbon. Now, that man, Du Bois, knew more about how he found it, the circumstances surrounding how he found it, and the creature more than anyone that ever lived. And his final conclusion was, it was a gibbon, like a baboon. X, again. Which brings us to Homo neanderthalensis, or Homo neanderthal. Now, the Neanderthal man, let me say a few things about him real quickly. We used to call him a different specific name. Homo, like ours, we're called Homo sapiens. And we said he was a different species from us. We no longer call him Homo neanderthalis, we call him Homo sapien. He has been promoted, he is understood to be completely every bit man. Unfortunately, the first one we ever found, and you've seen pictures of him, they look like brutes, you know, you know, real brutish looking, heavy ridge over his eyes, and just really looks like a something out of a alley-oop. Well, unfortunately, the first one we ever found, not only, see, all the Neanderthals, now we've found several hundred of these remains now of him, several hundred, almost, many of them almost complete. All of them suffered from a lack of vitamin D and had rickets. This gave some deficiencies in their bone structure. But the first one we found, and what I'm about to tell you is the consensus of medical opinion of evolutionary medical doctors, that he not only had rickets, he suffered from a tremendously advanced case of arthritis. And so the reason he looked so stooped and slumped and bent was because he was all doubled up with arthritis. The rest of them have not nearly been that stooped. And in fact, the truth is, Homo neanderthalis looks so much like us, all these other ones that we found since finding the first one, that if he walked in this room tonight, you wouldn't even take a second glance. But you'd, and he'd be suffering from rickets, and you'd think the poor guy needs a little milk and some rest, you know, and some vitamin D from the sunshine. But other than that, he really looked just like us. In fact, he was religious. They buried their dead. That means that he believed in a life after death. The only creatures that ever buried their dead are creatures that believe there's a life after death. I wonder where he got that idea. God put it in him. They had art. They buried their dead. They used weapons and they used tools. And in fact, his brain capacity, in some cases of the ones we found, have been larger than modern man's and ours even. And some of them have been smaller. And he was found, the first ones were found about 100 years ago. So he's one of us. He is now considered to be Homo sapiens. So what's the difference? Okay? And remember, radioactive carbon-14 dating, when taking into consideration the 25% error in the formula, now dates to be less than 10,000 years old. Homo neanderthalis. Okay? So next comes Cro-Magnon. Beloved, the only difference between him and modern man was a cultural step. Basically, he was a nomad. And the only thing that sets him apart physically, for the most part, he was maybe a little bit more powerfully built through the chest, but he'd make a good tight end at Notre Dame. Okay? And you wouldn't notice any difference. You just say, boy, that guy's got a good physique, and that'd be about it. But the only difference, He had cave art and everything else. Is they had not civilized to the point that they had cities and things like that where we find him.
Look at this slide of the Neanderthal man. Here are 9 different interpretations by evolutionists of the same skull. You can't even tell it's the same person. They look nothing alike. Isn't it incredible? Look at this one done by evolutionists. Done of a Neanderthal skull. This one looks exactly like I do, and look at the other one. Looks almost like an ape man. You can see that this is really not true science. These physical anthropologists simply are telling us it's scientific, but it isn't. Can you believe the incredible differences in these? And so, beloved, we are being coerced and intimidated and being asked to give up our faith in the accuracy and inspiration of scriptures over a few teeth, bone fragments, and skull fragments. Stay with the Bible. We've got the answers. We're the only people that know who came first, the chicken or the egg. It doesn't say that God rolled a bunch of eggs by Adam. It says God marched the animals by Adam, and he named them. Stick with God. We know the answers.
I hope that settles some questions in some of your hearts and minds. Now, just for example, there's one interesting case. In the Alps Mountains, just to show you how ridiculous this can get, there's a fossil, and he's above another fossil, and he shouldn't be there. And so all the geological thinking came up with, there was only one place it could come from, and that was it had to come from northern Africa. In other words, the fossil, the rock, had to be thrust all the way from northern Africa to the Swiss Alps. Have you got that? All that movement, that was the only way they could explain it, the geologist. Now, see, engineers and physicists are bullheaded. They have a tendency to want to put pencil and paper to wild remarks. And so some engineers calculated the strength of the rocks themselves in the Alps Mountains that these fossils were in. It's really a very easy thing to do. Then they calculated the force required to shove this enormous, huge block of rock from Africa to the Swiss Alps. And their conclusion was the force was so great, it was greater than the strength of the rocks, and the rocks would have pulverized into powder under that kind of force. Well, the geologist says, yeah, but there it is. And the engineer said, yeah, it's there all right, friend, but it could not get there the way you said it got there. Now, I want to say this about fossil gaps. There are gaps in the fossils between every single group of any major consequence. You're always hearing about missing links. I want you to know that we're not just looking for, quote, missing links from man and man's ancestor, but there's nothing but one continuous missing link all through the geological section. For example, let me just give you an example. See, actually, according to neo-Darwin evolutionism, all animals are related because they all started out back there in the primordial ooze as chemicals, and then that first little glob came to life. And so everything came out of him. So all animals are related. Now, I am not an animal. I am a man. I am different from the animals. I have not only a body and a soul like animals have, and my soul is my mind, my intellect, my emotions, my ego, which animals have up to a point. I am different. I have a spirit. I am not like the animals. I am like God. God is a tripartite being, and so am I. There are tremendous, tremendous gaps in the fossils between every major group and even within groups. The best place you could possibly go would be to the Grand Canyon to look. And they tell you what you're going to see, but when you go there, actually, you can see animals in one layer, and they're different from the animals above it. They're similar but different. But there's no way that there's ever in this kind of step. In other words, the steps are too great for a mutant to even do. For if there was that kind of great mutation, it would have been lethal and destroyed it. All evolutionists know this. You see, by evolution, dogs and cats are related a few generations removed, okay? This means that what you should find in the fossil record, if evolution were true,
is somewhere back a common ancestor of the cat and the dog. And then suddenly there was some sort of mutation in the genes so that the next generation, something came out slightly more cat than dog going one direction, and something came out slightly more dog than cat on the other. And so each lineage would then go on developing separately, where one began, you know, where it was there was this common ancestor and it would be hard to tell them apart. And then gradually and more as time went on, through more natural selection and more mutation of genes supposedly, this one began to look more like a cat, more like a cat, more like a cat, and this one more like a dog, more like a dog. Finally end up with cats and dogs. But all through this,
During the first stages, as it separated from the cat and dog stage, you could hardly tell the critters apart. It would be almost impossible to make a taxonomic classification of them. So that this would take millions and millions of years for this kind of change to take place. So therefore, don't you understand what I'm saying is, we should find literally millions upon millions of transitional forms so that it'd be almost impossible to even classify them. It'd be hard to tell whether it was a putty dog or a kitty, or a kitty dog, or a doggy cat. And yet you can't, but you don't ever find these kind of huge gaps. Why don't you? Where are those? Surely we should find some of them. Because they would be living simultaneously along with each other. Surely with as many millions and millions of years as this kind of series would have taken to, quote, evolve, there should have been, surely we would have had some fossils. Even though it's difficult to become a fossil, surely nature can't be that, quote, capricious against the evolutionist to not give him a single missing example. See, if we could just ever see just a few of those missing transitional forms, we could say, well, maybe these guys are right. Of course, the point is they're not right, and that's why we don't find them, as the Bible tells us. Death came as a result of one man's sin. Man sinned, and that brought about death. Now, this is not just true about dogs and cats. This is true about every single major change in the family tree coming from that one glob. You see, if all entities were truly in a state of evolutionary flux, taxonomic classification would be absolutely impossible. In biology, for example, it would be impossible to tell where cats leave off and dogs begin. See, classification, but you need to remember this, classification tables require not only similarities, but differences and gaps. If an evolutionary continuum existed, there would be no gaps in the animals that are alive today. You could not possibly classify animals today. Similarities in structure don't necessarily imply evolutionary descent from a common ancestor. It could just simply mean that they were created by a common designer of similar structures made for similar functions and different structures made for different functions. We need to understand that natural selection really just acts like a sieve that screens out the novel features as unfit variants or as defective mutants. And in doing so, it tends to preserve the status quo of a set system. If the environment changes enough, there is enough variational potential in the DNA, usually, to allow some sort of adjustment to a new environment before it's eliminated. So you see, natural selection is a very strong device to conserve the created kinds. It's a conservative device. And to conserve the balance of nature. It does not create anything new, novel, or higher. It only allows things to go out horizontally, not upward, higher. May I be bold? Extinction is an example of decay, not development. Extinction is the result of decay and degeneration, not of development. Meditate on that a while. You see, the evolutionist assumes that the accumulations of many small minor changes eventually would result in a new basic type of increasing complexity, but it's purely an assumption. What he really needs is some experimental evidence, or since he can't obtain that, he needs some hard fossil evidence or historical proof, but he really doesn't have any of that. Another form of change that is often cited by the evolutionists as evidence for evolution, for example, is the origin of domesticated plants and animals by artificial selection and crossbreeding. But you see, evidence of this kind is totally irrelevant to the problem, because nothing really new or more complex ever arises.